You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
And welcome to episode 316 of the podcast. And in this episode, I got on Dr. Sophie Suri to talk about her OCD story. And in particular, we talk about the trauma she experienced from the loss of her parents, health and harm themes, starting therapy, her experience of trauma, starting to see triggers as opportunities to practice her therapy skills. Sophie shares some of the most helpful strategies that she learned in therapy. We discuss her future research and the book she's been writing, as well as finding her purpose and why. We also discuss intuition, what else helped her in her journey, and much more. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you to Sophie for her time. I really appreciate it. And of course, thank you to you guys. As always, it means a lot. And without further ado, here is Sophie.
Welcome to the show, Sophie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And as you know, I'd love to hear your OCD story. So you can share it in as little or as much detail as you want.
Yeah, sure. So I kind of remember my first OCD kind of thoughts or obsessions probably began when I was 8. My dad had just died. And I remember I used to just feel really anxious. And I used to touch door frames and turn lights on and off a certain number of times and shout through to my mum at night, you know, I love you, good night. And it had to be a certain amount of time, just answer in a certain way. And that's the first time I kind of remember, you know, having obsessions and compulsions. But if I look back, it goes all the way back, you know, to just after my dad's death. And then I was always a very anxious kid. And when I was 13, my mum got diagnosed with a brain tumor. And that kind of like blasted my belief in the world, that the world was, you know, it wasn't safe. You know, people said, oh, everything's okay. And I was like, it isn't. I've just seen, you know, with my own eyes that it isn't. And so I started keeping these lists really obsessively. And if I ever got that feeling, do you know when you go into a room and you've gone to get something and you think, what have I come in here for? I've forgotten something. If ever I got those feelings during the day, I had to write a little list of when I got them, the time they got them. And I had to, on a night, sit down every day and spend about an hour and a half going through the list and replaying in my head when that happened, that I'd forgotten about something, just in case it had been, I'd forgotten to turn something off. I'd said something that I shouldn't have said that could hurt someone or could get me in trouble. So I used to ruminate for ages, you know, some running jokes, Sophie's going to pack a school bag and I'd be gone for 2 hours. You know, I had no idea it was OCD then. And I don't think anyone did. I think everyone just thought, you know, they've been through a lot and she's, you know, she's quite, you know, highly strung and anxious. And then I suppose my teenage years, I had a lot of control strategies. I had an eating disorder, trying to control everything and be the perfect student. I'd say control would be the one word that probably sums up that, you know, from being 13 to 20. And then when I was, it must have been 2009. Yeah, I was training to be a physio and I was getting all these really intrusive thoughts about door health kind of related. You know, have I got cancer? Might have a stroke? Lots of different, all about death kind of thoughts and suppose I die. And they got to such a point that I was at the doctor's all the time. I was checking. Google was my best friend. You know, and no one, like, never Google symptoms, you know, just don't. There's so many things out there. And I went down every rabbit hole going. You know, I was really, like, really convinced that I was dying. And then in September, October 2009, it got so bad that I was admitted into a psychiatric hospital. And that's when I got diagnosed with OCD. I remember they came in and I didn't know how they were going to treat it. I knew nothing about treatment. I'd heard of OCD, kind of how I suppose it's been badly portrayed in the press. And she said, we're going to do CBT. And I just thought, really? You're going to talk to me and that is really going to make a difference. And I was adamant it wouldn't work. Mm. But I went through it because I think I was driving my mum insane at the time. And she was like, please. So I just kind of did it to keep everyone, you know, quiet because looking back, I was a nightmare to live with at that time. It wasn't what I wanted, but that was just the way it was. So I had CBT, very lucky to have a fantastic therapist for, I think I had CBT for about a year. You know, it was very intense at first and then went on to being, bigger gaps between sessions. And despite my best efforts to think it wouldn't work, it got me back to working in the health field. You know, I couldn't believe the change. I suppose... something twigged, something changed. I didn't believe it would, but it did.
Just quickly jump in there. Did that CBT involve ERP at the time?
It did. Yeah. ERP. I had to divorce Google, which I hated because I'm a researcher and I know where to find the research. And there's always one paper on something. Oh, there's always one out there. And so I would find the one, you know, I used to think, oh my God, I've had too much of these chemicals in my diet for this long. Mm-hmm. And I'd go and do the research on the exact chemical. It got really, really bad. So I had to divorce Google searches and ERP. And we did, mindfulness was kind of brought up. And it wasn't such a big thing then, but my therapist did bring it in and, you know, I was introduced to it. I didn't have a massive awareness of it, but it was something that it did help me. But when I finished the therapy, I honestly thought we put a relapse plan together and I honestly thought that's it, I'm cured. This will never come back. And I kind of just got on. I was still trying to control other areas of my life, very much so. But I just got on. I went back into studying. And I think that must have been 24, 25. And I started a PhD in health. So I was well and truly back into all the things that I was scared of. So it just shows that you can go back to something and the power of therapy. You know, I didn't believe it would work. So if anyone out there thinks it won't work, you don't have to necessarily believe it, but you have to trust the process. And then when I was 29, so that's like 5 years later, mum's brain tumor came back. And I was probably, still doing the PhD. And my kind of go-to coping mechanism was OCD because it made me feel safe, you know? So I was obsessively checking my work. It really came out in there. And I had probably, when she did die in the September 2014, I had two pretty major relapses. And that very much brought my harm OCD to the surface. So things like driving, things like I struggled massively with making a cup of tea. I used to think, have I put bleach in the kettle instead of water? So I was living in a flat by myself at the time, and I every other week had a new kettle, and everyone was like, "Why? Nice new kettle, but why?" And so I had this big stash in my spare room of 15 kettles. I couldn't afford it, but my OCD was like, but if someone drinks out of that, and you're going to damage them. And I struggled with, I take medication for my OCD, and I had this really bad obsession with, suppose I drop a tablet somewhere, suppose I drop it in one of my bags or wrap it up in a present for someone, you know, gets caught in a kid's present. So I couldn't wrap presents. I had to go through everything before I went in and out of the house to make sure there were no traces of tablets anywhere. So my harm OCD really impacted me. And, you know, at one point I couldn't even get out one room without the compulsion, without the obsessions, just feeling like my nervous system was on fire. And I always knew it felt like there was something else wrong. I didn't quite know what, but my anxiety was always at about an 80. And I, you know, to do an ERP with your anxiety so high already, is that being your baseline? You do ERP and it kind of, you're overloaded and so you fail. So I was trying to do some ERP at the time, but I eventually it came out that I still had a lot of underlying trauma. You know, a lot of trauma lives in the nervous system. You know, it very much lives in your body. And I started to educate myself on how to deal with trauma. And I remember one night I was lying down and my body started shaking. And I thought, my mum had epilepsy. And I thought, oh my God, I'm having a fit. And then I could stop it at any point. So I was like, oh, well, this is really weird. And I kind of let it continue and let my body shake. And afterwards, I just felt the biggest relief. I felt like my nervous system had gone to like down from, you know, 80 to 30. And so I thought, there's something in that. So I started like investigating. I found out it was called somatic experiencing. And I started working on the trauma. And that didn't, you know, get rid of the OCD, but it brought me to a level where I could then do my, you know, do the work that I needed to do to get better. And I had a fantastic psychiatrist and therapist again. It was CBT. And they helped me get through and finish the PhD. So, you know, that was probably the second biggest part of the of my OCD, the second, you know, one of the worst bits. And then after the OCD, I kind of had to get really real. After the PhD, I had to get really real. You know, a couple of years, I'd done it a lot longer than I thought it would. And I was functional, but I still had a lot of obsessions and a lot of compulsions. And I didn't want to go back into research. I just needed kind of a little bit of space, a little bit of time out. So I got a job at Marks and Spencer's, which is not far from me. And I remember the day I went in for the induction, and we were the first of a cohort of Christmas temps to start. And they said, you know, which job do you want? Do you want to be part of the customer assistant team or the store operations? And I was like trying to play it cool. And she was like, I was like, well, we know which one's more fun. And she said, well, you know, they're both very hard, but store operations is all about looking after, locking up the building, looking after the health and safety, you know, temperatures of fridges, freezers, all that kind of stuff. And so my OCD is freaking out in the corner. But I'm trying to play cool. And she said, if it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you. And it was that one thing she said. I said, okay, I'll take store ops. I leave the store about half an hour later. I get home and my brother was like, so how did it go? And we've got this look between us, you know, when things have gone wrong in the past, of just kind of, you are kidding. And he was like, well, what have you done? And so I told him and explained. And at that time, I was still struggling to, you know, to shut my own front door, to turn my own oven off, to cook, lots of different kind of things again. And I thought, well, how can I do this? I'm going to have to ring them up and say, I need to swap back over, you know, to the other role. And then something inside me, and it's something that, it's like my intuition. And it's grown much bigger. It's like a voice inside me, you know, the one that kind of I think we've all got it. We hear it, but dismiss it 80% of the time. You know, it says go left and we think, oh no, we go right. It says go and buy this. And you're like, oh no, no, I'll ignore it. So it was that part of me that had said yes to the job. And it was that part of me that I thought, if I could just look at this differently as an opportunity to grow, it's going to challenge me like crazy. But if I can get through this and use it as like my training ground, I can kind of, you know, convey mentally fit. And so a couple of weeks into the job and it's hard. I'm struggling to do date checks. I'm struggling to lock up. And I remember contacting, I'd heard of Dr. Reed Wilson and I read his book. And again, that intuition inside me was kind of like, you need to contact him and you need to arrange some sessions. So I did. And basically, to cut a long story short, we used Marks and Spencer's as training ground, you know, a mental training gym for me to get better for my harm OCD. So the shifts start at 5 a.m. So I'd get up at 3 to psych myself up. So I'd be sat there trying to psych myself up, thinking, oh my God, in however long, 2 hours, I'm going to be head down in broccoli trying to, you know, doing a date check and my OCD going, have you checked that one? Did you leave that one on the floor? And you're under time pressures to do things. So I didn't have time to go back and double check all my work. And with Reed, we worked on a lot of things, but mainly Reed's huge on having a strategy, you know, really big on having a strategy. So we saw each one as like, you know, like a tennis match. You know who your opponent is. You know the tricks they're going to pull. And I went in with my attack and I knew the moves I had to do, no matter how they felt, I had to execute. You know, I love Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. And I used to read a lot about them and their training, and it's just practice, execute. You know, it's all about mindset and just repetition. You know, getting your brain, that neuroplasticity in your brain, you know, your brain can change. Yeah. And I just kept thinking, my brain can change, neuroplasticity, repeat. And Reed's also really big on self-talk. So I really had to work on what I said to myself in those moments. Usually I'd be slating myself, but this time I had, you know, like Reed's voice in my head, and he used to say, scurry away, scurry away. And all I could hear on my shoulder was like Reed going, scurry away, when I'm trying to like look at things or like move on. So I really had to work on how I spoke to myself and strategy, how I spoke to myself and keeping it simple. When my OCD goes kind of really, you know, really gets on one, sounds very busy. Everything, you know, I don't want lots of different things to have to do to get better. I need to be a simple strategy that I can just go in and execute. And so Reed's very much about, it's not about the content of your thoughts. So he didn't want me going back and, you know, getting involved with my thoughts. It was very much elevating myself to what he calls, he treats all kind of your obsessions that and the intrusive thoughts as noise. And he was like, I just want you to elevate yourself above them. You're dealing with generic uncertainty. Deal with the feeling and move on. And that made a huge difference, because it suddenly cut you off and all those, you didn't have to start engaging with 1,000 thoughts and, you know, arguing back with them or anything. It literally just was a very quick move. Like, I think of it, if you're a player on, say, a football pitch or a rugby pitch, you haven't got time when someone's coming towards you. You haven't got time to, you know, to think about things. You have to act, and you have to act quick to get through the gap. And so I think that was the biggest thing, was keeping it simple and just treating it as just one thing. It's all just uncertainty. So I just knew when I got that, I knew the strategy to execute. And I made huge progress, you know, to the point where I could lock the whole store up. I could do everything, check the bakeries without thinking, you know, the whole place will burn down. You know, many times I did come home and just sit there and think, oh my God, we're going to get broken into tonight. This is, you know, this is going to be it. And yeah, I got to the point where I could lock the whole store up and do all my jobs, do date checks in record time, you know, and I was like, oh my God, I can actually do it. And it kind of gave me this confidence to know that, you know, the strategy that I've got, that I practice with Reed, I can now just take and implement anywhere. So I finished at Marks's probably about 2 months ago, and I got a job back in research. And, you know, as soon as I started, all the thoughts come back up, all the want to double and triple and a million times check your work. Yeah. So I have very strict rules when I'm doing my work now. Two checks and I'm done. Mm. No matter how I feel, it's two checks and I'm done. I have a strategy before I do my work. I keep it simple. It's uncertainty. You know, I've still got Reed on my shoulder telling me to move on. He'll be very glad. Yeah, he's just scurry away, scurry away. And that's all I could hear at 5 a.m. going through my head, checking broccoli. You know, so I've got all those tools now, and I'm so grateful to be in a position to be back in the research field. And luckily, I've got an opportunity to do some research into OCD. So we're going to be researching long-term health conditions, a lot about self-management and providing more holistic healthcare. I think when someone's got anything long-term, you have to look at the whole package, you know, the physical, the psychological, the social and the spiritual as well, I think. Mm-hmm. You can't leave any gaps. You have to look, you have to make sure that everywhere's covered. And that is, I think, what increases your resilience against relapse. I'm not saying relapse won't happen, but I'm saying that it's, you need to, you know, you can't, like your social connection, for example, if you haven't got that connection, like we're wired for connection as human beings, it's part of who we are. It's just a primal, it's something so primal. And I think if we haven't got that, we can do all the ERP in the world, change our brains, but then we're missing that connection to other people. So I think that's when you're vulnerable to your addictive tendencies maybe coming back. Yeah, I've probably gone on far too long with my story.
That's good. So, yeah, go on. Were you going to say something?
That's where I'm at now. I'm at a place where I've got the choice. You know, my OCD hasn't gone. I'm not going to say I'm completely OCD free and have no obsessive thoughts, because everyone has thoughts, intrusive thoughts, that they're normal. And I have to work hard every day and be aware and have a certain, my own self-management strategy. You know, there's certain things that I'm religious about that I do that I know keep me well. And I think that's part of any long-term management of something. OCD, I don't think it goes. I think what happens is you build such a life, a lot. You have to build a life alongside it. You can't just treat OCD and forget to build a life alongside it. You have to really find what lights someone up, find what their passion is, find what their why is. And I think get that alongside the OCD to build a life that is full of meaning for them. And yeah, that's what I am now. I'm the OCD hasn't gone, but I'm living in my purpose. Mm-hmm. I'm not living in my OCD, and I know the difference. And yeah, I get to choose now, which is a gift. I'm just so grateful.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I can't remember if it was Viktor Frankl or Nietzsche. And he said something like, when we transform pain into purpose, in some way it can no longer be suffering. I've butchered that, but it's along those lines.
Yeah, and I think
they both said something similar to that.
Yeah, and I think they said something on the lines of kind of, if you've got a why, you can get through anything.
Yeah.
If you've got a strong enough why,
You can bear almost anyhow.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that one was Nietzsche.
Yeah, because life's hard and there are going to be ups and downs. Just because you haven't, just your OCD is not running forefront, life is hard. Mm-hmm. But it's so beautiful as well. And I think when you're driven by the why, by your purpose, by what lights you up and brings you passion, I think you can overcome anything. And that's what drives me, is my why. That's what keeps me going through the bits that I think, oh my God, like coming on the OCD stories, so many things I was thinking, oh my God, people will know this about me and they'll know that. And then I have to go back to why I'm doing it. And it's not for me to look a certain way. It's because I want to help someone else. You know, I very much believe we learn by story. You know, you look at the Bible.
Yeah.
You look at any like sacred texts, or if you go back and, you know, things like that. I think we learn through story. And that's why I love the OCD stories, because through other people's stories, I found nuggets that have lit a path for me. Mm-hmm. I used to listen in 2015. I know when you first started, I think it was in 2015.
Yeah, end of 2015.
Yeah, I used to listen on my exercise bike, cry my eyes out in some kind of like, you know, OCD thing. And I used to listen to the stories and just find a nugget of wisdom that someone else had found. And I think put them all together and, you know, it lit a path for me. So I thought, if I'm living by my purpose and my why to help others, then I have to come on here. You know, it doesn't matter what people think of me. But it's, yeah, you've got to live by your why, be driven by something that's much bigger than yourself. Mm. You know, it's about giving back. I think that's what fulfills us as people and as humans. Yeah. It's not about the external. It's about what we can actually give, how we can grow. And I kind of see suffering as something, or obstacles and challenges as things that really evolve me as a person. Mm. and mean that I can give more back to other people. That's what we're here for, do you know, to lead our own lives and to fulfill our own potential. But I think bringing everyone else along with us. And I think, yeah, that's my why.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, look, thank you for sharing your story. And as you say, for being open, I appreciate it. So, you know, the trauma link is controversial at times, but definitely for some people it's there. You know, it's undeniable. The research shows it for some people. And so, you know, I appreciate you sharing your experience with trauma. I just wonder if there's anything else you wanted to say on trauma, how it impacted OCD, or just anything generally on it.
I think trauma, I think it destroyed my belief in the world.
Okay.
You know, I think from being very young, and when my dad died, I think that kind of knocked my confidence. You know, I was, before he died, I had kind of an idyllic life. You know, I felt very safe. I never thought about it, but I did feel very safe. And then, you know, my dad dies one day suddenly, and my belief in the world kind of took a huge hit. So bad things do happen. Mm. And then I may have got over that much better if my mum hadn't have got the tumor when we were 13. And, you know, she left with epilepsy and other problems. And I mean, she was an absolute warrior. The way she's the one of the people who's taught me how to really live your life. You know, she'd look deaf in the face, and she had so much wisdom. But her getting ill kind of shook my belief in life for the second time. And I was like, the two most pivotal people in my life, how can you tell me things don't go wrong all the time? I've got the evidence here. Everything does go wrong. So I think the trauma kind of, I think the obsessive tendencies would have still been there. Looking back in family history, I think they would have still been there, but I don't know if they would express themselves. They would have expressed themselves as much as they did. I think, you know, it kind of, my trauma comp- kind of made it a very good environment for OCD to breed. Yeah. And I had no idea what OCD was, no skills back when I was that age 30 years ago. Oh my God. Mental health for children wasn't really a thing. Actually, it wasn't a thing at all. And I remember when my mum died, and I remember clearing things out, and she was very wise, and she was a nurse, and I found lots of books on child psychology. So she had obviously been looking to try and help and try and do things, but then she had become ill. So I think, yeah, looking back then, it wasn't a thing for kids. So I just soldiered on because that's what you did. Yeah. You get on. But of course, you get on and your nervous system's primed for you know, stuck in fight and flight and or freeze. And it's just primed on alert. I was hyper alert to everything. So I think the link for me was the trauma destroyed my belief in the world and probably set a very good breeding ground for something which I maybe had a predisposition to. I think that's where the link kind of like evolved.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. And like you say, it's a lot to go through at such a young age. It's a lot to go through at any age, but especially at a young age.
I've got a twin brother. And so we've, you know, my mum's best friend always used to say, there's a reason you had twins. And so we've been through everything together. You know, we've seen everything together. And I think it's just, that's been a blessing, you know, to have him by my side. And to this day, you know, we've got each other's backs. That's been a blessing.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Okay, so actually one other thing before I go to my next question. With where Reed was saying about self-talk, and I guess I just wanted to highlight it. I think it's a great point. It's something I say to my clients around. I talk more about like the compassionate voice and raising that up, and like to drown out that inner critic or the OCD voice or the anxious voice. So I like the way you said it of like, yeah, just almost having him in your ear, but it was your voice coaching you through it, just saying, move on, you know?
Yeah, because there's always going to be a competing voice, you know, where I think it's like, you know, which one do you feed? I think that's very much the, it's been said in so many different metaphorical ways and throughout the ages.
Yeah.
But it is very much, we have these two competing parts of ourselves, and it is learning to big one of them up and to really like your wise self, really work with that part of you and grow it, because you can't fight the other one by just trying to ignore it. It'll just shout back louder. So I think the self-talk that Reed taught me was really important, you know, to scurry away. Hey, yeah, self-talk I think is huge. And your own voice is what you hear all the time. Yep. You hear it more than anything else in the whole world. So you've got to be your biggest cheerleader. You really have. And it's not some kind of like positive self, you know, like everything's going to be fine. It's no, you've got to toughen up that little part of you because it will guide you. And I think it's like I always, my intuition, I'd say, is probably one of the biggest things that I've grown over the past probably 5 or 6 years. I recognize of, you know, everyone's got intuition, that, like I said, that feeling of that gut, you know, that you should go and do something, but you say no and it all works out wrong, or you think, I knew that was going to happen, and you didn't trust that little part of you. And what I've learned is the more I've trusted that part of me, the more I've grown and created this kind of blanket where I feel I can go into the more scary parts of life, because I have such a faith that I'm being guided. Mm-hmm. It gives me a lot of freedom to know that no matter what happens, I will be shown the way. Back in, I think it was 2015, when Mum had just died, and I wasn't good. And I remember I was in town one day and I was walking past WH Smith's, which is like a book kind of stationery store if you don't live in the UK. And I had this real strong pull to go in. And I was in a, you know, I was in a bad mood. And I was like, I'm not going. And I was like, and something in me was like, you need to go in there. And I was like, I really don't need to. And anyway, I went in. And I went, I just knew I had to go to this, it was like the spiritual self-help section. And I was like, oh, great. And I picked this book up by Dr. Wayne Dyer. And he's a very famous, he's passed away now, but he's a very famous spiritual teacher. And it lit something up in me. I don't know what it was, but I got home and it lit kind of this, I call it in my book that I'm writing, I call it like this quest. It lit something up in me that there is another way to live. And that if you can embrace it and practice faith every single day, and kind of view life as this opportunity to grow, you know, it's like your classroom, this other way of living, you will live an amazing life. And I started to, it took a long time to learn to trust that part of me. It was like a relationship, I suppose. If, you know, you start going out with someone you've only met once, can I trust them doing that? And then you build this relationship over time. Oh, they do keep to their word. They do keep their promise. And it's like that little part of me that I now have this relationship with where I just know it has my back. And I know it's the part of me that's connected to something so much bigger, whether you call it God, the universe, no matter what you call it, higher power, it drives me. And it's what gives me the strength to go for the things that otherwise I would shy away from. You know, I go for, you know, like the job that I just got, that came up and I just knew I had to go for it. I knew that Marks and Spencer's was an opportunity to grow. I'd say working on learning to trust that part of yourself is probably a huge pillar in recovery for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I know, I mean, I haven't seen it for many years. I have seen comments before of people criticizing gut instinct when OCD is also in tow, because they're like, well, what's my gut and what's the OCD voice? And I don't necessarily want to get into too much of that because I feel, I don't know, but it's a tough one. I mean, I agree with you. I think there is something, and sometimes the decisions I make, it just feels, I'm just being called, or it feels right and it works out, or sometimes it doesn't feel right. I do it anyway and it goes wrong and I'm like, I should have just listened to myself. Yeah. So I think it's very complex, but I just wanted to flag that in case there are people listening that are like,
I think Reed doesn't like me calling it gut instinct, because he's like, he doesn't like me calling it gut instinct. So it's kind of, it's a real, like you say, it's a real, it's probably a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah, we still wouldn't have the answer at the end.
No. Reed doesn't like me calling it gut instinct. It's more kind of intuition. It's probably a whole thing in itself. It's just a knowing. I would say it's just a knowing that.
Yeah.
I always put it down to the analogy, like that thing that you know you should do. Like when I'm doing a compulsion, I know I shouldn't be doing it. I know there's another way, or this part of me that's like, come on, you know, back off.
Yeah. Do you think that part of you became clearer when you got more of a handle on OCD? Or was it still very much present while you're in the grips of OCD?
I think I was in a really bad place when Mum died, and my OCD was really, you know, ramped up. And that was when I kind of heard it clearest. So I think I think sometimes when you're at your worst, you're rock bottom, you're on your knees, you're willing to listen before I just dismiss it all the time. And then my OCD, how does it affect it? It's like a relationship with it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Do you know, I just know, am I trusting my OCD and my fear voice, or am I trusting my intuition? Yeah. And I just see it as two paths, and I get to choose every day which one I live. Yeah. And if I go, it's my choice which one I go down. You know, it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy or comfortable, yeah. but I have the awareness through doing mindfulness training and meditation. I have that awareness, which is probably a huge crux again in recovery. Once you gain that awareness to step back, you gain the ability to make the decisions.
Yeah. 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 Which voice to listen to.
Yeah.
And of course, you being called into WH Smith's, I say called. Anyone listening who's religious or is spiritual, they may be saying, well, that was just God, you know, guiding you. Someone else was just, no, it's your intuition, as you say.
I think it's the same thing. It's just, what do you call it?
Exactly.
You know, it's something bigger than ourselves, I think, is the key thing. A higher, a larger power. I really believe we're connected to something a lot bigger, and that we're here for a reason. I don't know. That's just what I feel, and they're my beliefs. Other people might completely be like, "What?" Like my brother's. It's quite funny. He's got kind of a very different approach to things. He's very scientific. So we can have conversations for hours where he's like, yeah, but where's the proof?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, well, there is. And I'm there trying to find every book that I know, you know, this proof here. Yeah,
where's the randomized control trial?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, he's very kind of, really? And so I always think if I could ever... I always think God puts people in your life to test you. And I think I'm always trying to kind of like explain things. And he really makes me think about how I explain that. And I'm constantly kind of sort of developing to make it clearer of how I explain that kind of that higher kind of power, because he questions it like crazy.
Yeah. Well, you both probably improve each other, right? Because he brings you more that way and you bring him more this way.
Yeah.
Even if he won't admit it. I'm just assuming he won't.
He knows. He'll just smile at me. Or if he does kind of have one of those things where he agrees, he's like, yeah. So I'm like, yeah.
Change the subject. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you mentioned some of it, but other than like therapy and medication, what else helped you along the way and, you know, to this day, keep your sort of well-being up?
I think being exercise, you know, physical activity, getting out in nature, or just keeping physically fit, because anxiety can have such an impact on your body. And I think it's important to look after, you know, to look after your body and to eat right. You know, I'm very big into health and fitness. So I think having looking after your diet, sleep is a really big thing for me, making sure I get enough sleep. I know if I haven't had enough sleep, my OCD is worse, which played a factor at Marx's, because I was up at silly hours in the morning. So I was like, oh my God, it's going to be horrendous. So sleep's a big thing. I would say social support is massive. I know with the OCD community is fantastic. And over the years, I've been very lucky to, you know, to meet people who've helped me, you know, Shannon Shai and Sean Shinnick, you know, very dear friends. And I think that connection with someone who kind of knows what you're going through and can kind of coach you along, like peer support, that's a massive part of recovery. You know, I'd probably say if I had to name the things that help me recover would be medication. I still take medication. You know, it works for me. I think we've all got, there's not one kind of size fits all when it comes to recovery. I think we have to kind of piece our own package together. And for me, that's medication. Whether I'll always be medication, I don't know. I can't. I go bit by bit. You know, recovery is you don't need to look too far ahead. It's just, you know, I go each day by each day. Medication, mindfulness, having connection with other people, having that why, you know, being driven, being passionate about something is really big, because when you've had OCD for so long, you've got this big gap once the compulsions are less. Yeah. It's like you feel like, oh my God, where this is life, and you haven't had your time to create the life because you've been too busy doing compulsions. And I think trying to build that back up is a huge part of recovery, because otherwise you do go back into old habits. So yeah, that's why I think my new role in the research field is very much about integrating all of those pillars into someone's recovery plan. Because I know, you know, without physical, without the ERP, like the psychological, without the spiritual, and without the social, I wouldn't have the strength to go forward like as I want to.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're complex beings and we need many factors to help and heal. Okay, so, you know, words of hope for anyone listening that is having a tough time.
I think there's so much pain in OCD, so much pain and suffering. But I think if you can change your perspective, even slowly, you know, I think everything is one step at a time. A very dear family member always says to me, one brick at a time, you know, brick by brick. And it literally is. It's having those little leaps of faith every day, practicing, doing a few more bits that you couldn't do the day before, improving yourself, not taking going from A to Z in one. You know, it's, I know the pain, but I also know the power that you have. And I also know human potential. You know, human potential is so vast. We know our brains can change. We know so much now about, you know, we've seen so many people overcome big feats where we thought, oh my God, how did they do that? And I think that really inspires people with what can be achieved when the right systems are put in place. So with anyone suffering, I would say, look at those four pillars: the social, the physical, the psychological, and the spiritual. And just brick by brick, slowly edge your way forward. It's taken me a long time and I'm not perfect. I fail a lot. I failed so much, so many times in doing so many, you know, exposures. And I think, like we were talking before, I've got a quote on my wall by Michael Jordan, and it says that, you know, he's failed so many times, missed game-winning shots. But he says that's why he succeeds. And I think we have to view our failures, because we will mess up on our path. It's so hard to resist the compulsion. It really is. So I think we need to give ourselves some grace and to just know that there's some wisdom in each failure, and to use it to move forward. You know, failure is not final. It's just for that moment. So I think, again, it's perspective. But the key message is bit by bit, literally. It's one step at a time. The people you see who are further down the road than you, they've been on every little step that you're going down. So don't be too hard on yourself.
Absolutely, yeah, good point. So you've got a billboard. I'm laughing because, yeah, it's what Sean said. So you got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard?
I think I would put, there's a quote that I love, and it's by a Persian poet called Rumi. And it says, there's a voice that doesn't use words, listen. And I think that's what I'd put on there, because I think when we learn to listen, like I talked about, that part of ourselves, I think that's the bedrock. It will lead us to where we need to be, to the right book, to the right therapist. It will guide us. It's our inner sat-nav. If we can learn to connect back to that, I think that's probably the most important thing that drives me, and is what I would tell anyone. I wouldn't give them loads of information, because I think by listening to that part of themselves, they will be, yeah, they'll be shown everything. So yeah, I'd put that quote, "There's a voice that doesn't use words, listen," on the billboard.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. I like Rumi too.
Yeah.
So pick up the phone, called 20-year-old Sophie. What did you tell her?
We went back to this one as well.
All right. So just quickly, for anyone listening, when I said about, I was laughing because of what Sean said, Sean Shinnick, who's been on the show a couple of times, Sophie was chatting with him before and he was doing a mock interview with her, preparing her. And
he was being Stu.
Yeah, taking the mic.
Yeah, back to 20. 20 was really hard. And I think I would have taught her to step back, to learn to meditate. I would have taught her to give herself some space, because she had things coming up to go through that I couldn't have addressed with one little, you know, with one little piece of advice. I think to have some space and, again, connect back to that part of you that is guiding you. I think they're the two things I would have said to her, because I couldn't have fixed things in one flash, and I couldn't have stopped the things that were coming. But I think I could have empowered her with two tools of of listening and awareness, that would have kind of given her the right things she needed to move forward through the obstacles that were coming. That's what I would have said to her. Listen.
Nice. I like that. And then lastly, anything else you wish you could have shared today?
No, I'm just so grateful for everything you do. You know, it's helped me hugely. And I know it's helped so many people around the world, you know, from being on my exercise bike, crying, listening to other people's stories, to just learning, you know, from other therapists, from learning from the diverse range of people that you get on. I just want to say thank you. You made a huge difference to my life and to so many others. So that'd be all I'd probably want to add.
Thank you. No, it means a lot. Yeah, it does. And yeah, look, thank you for sharing your story. I know it's going to help many.
I hope so. I hope it does.
Yeah, nice. Oh, and lastly, when will the book be out, do you think?
What's so I'm aiming to try and get, I'm trying to maybe get a publisher, hopefully later on this year. Cool. So I know once things get into motion, it takes a couple of years. Yeah. So I'm going to be writing articles. I've written one on trauma. I don't think I've got anywhere. I'll probably give you the link to it. Yeah. So I'll be writing a lot of things and stories that will be going, that are like in the book. So, cool. You know, people can see snippets before,
nice.
Before it comes out.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'll put your Instagram and stuff so people can follow you if they want to stay up to date with that.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.